This is an ABC podcast.
This is ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
In regional news, it's all about telling the stories that happening over someone's back fence. It's that much more interesting and that much more relevant and that much more important when things are happening right next door. The locals are going to miss it.
Analysts say the closure of more regional newsrooms in Queensland and New South Wales is a blow for democracy. And the wayward cows causing mischief in Laverton.
Can you demonstrate to me the sound you make when you get the cows come over again?
Oh, this is going to be different.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide.
Well, as a former journalist and as a former newspaper editor, I'm saddened to see that there's going to be four news bureaus, one of which in my own electorate of Wagga Wagga, my own hometown indeed, is shutting after 30 years of dedicated service. We want more journalists. We want a bigger bank of cameras lining up at road project announcements such as today. We want to make sure that the community hears the stories, hears the news and sees the local faces. We just don't want to be force-fed metropolitan news from metropolitan stations, which is on repeat over and over in our regional centres. We want to see local people who are making the headlines, who are making the local news.
Acting Prime Minister Michael McCormack reacting to the news that Wyn News will axe services in New South Wales and Queensland. It will close its offices in Bundaberg, Albury, Orange, Dubbo and Wagga, with staff given a week's notice that they've lost their jobs. Politicians and business people alike have criticised the decision today, saying it's a blow to regional Australia. And it's understood the decision is based on advertising competition and the commercial viability of funding news in regional centres. Alan Reader is a former chief of staff with Wyn. He says the closures are not good enough for democracy and accountability.
Very sad for the people involved. It's very sad for democracy. Local news plays a huge role in keeping our local leaders accountable. Journalists getting local mayors and local MPs angry is their job. This is one less layer of that system that keeps our leaders accountable. In regional news, it's all about telling the stories that happening over someone's back fence. It's that much more interesting and that much more relevant and that much more important when things are happening right next door. The locals are going to miss it. Some hard questions need to be asked, I think, about the Wyn organisation's recent couple of years, the decision for all sorts of complex network reasons to move from one network to another has proved to be a ratings disaster. And that's something that now local communities and local journalists are feeling the impact of.
Former Wyn News Chief of Staff Alan Reader speaking there. Jock Cheatham is a senior journalism lecturer at Charles Sturt University, which has supplied cadet journalists to Wyn for many years. He's concerned about the employment issues the Wyn cuts will create.
Immediately, three impacts came to mind. The first was regional jobs. Every job in the region is a critical thing. They're not easy to come by, and there's quite a few jobs involved here across the regions, 30 to 40 jobs. Another impact is coverage of local stories. Local media is critical and it's in decline, and that's a real issue. The thing about local media is that it's the community speaking to itself, to the community, and this will lessen under what's happened. And the third thing is that there's fewer opportunities now for local journalism students to have training and early career jobs.
Jock Cheatham, senior journalism lecturer at Charles Sturt University. Laurie Zion is a professor of journalism at La Trobe University, and he's been following the decline in regional journalism since 2010, with a particular focus on the impact of journalism redundancies. Professor Zion, what do you think these newsroom closures mean for communities like Orange and Bundaberg?
I think the consequences are really serious. When you have both the local newspapers, which have suffered steep declines in the number of journalists, especially since 2015, when you have that continuing to happen, plus problems with staffing levels in radio and television, a lot of communities that are in some cases quite large communities, yes, the ABC is still there and they're still plugged into national media, but the extent to which the information needs of people in communities when it comes to what's happening in their own area are being met is really questionable. And I should add that this is a global issue. We've seen this problem unravel at much greater speed in the US, where the term news deserts has been coined to characterize communities where newspapers that once might have published a few times a week are publishing once or twice a week, and where staffing levels have gone down to such low levels that a lot of the content that people receive in their so-called local publications is actually aggregated from a range of different areas. And so the information needs, and you could argue from that, the kind of civic engagement that people have with their communities is hampered by the fact that there aren't local journalists on the ground covering the stories that affect people directly in their communities.
So that phenomenon of what you're describing as news deserts, what happens to a community when they find themselves in essentially a news desert where they're just not getting that local voice and hearing what people have to say to them in their community?
Well, research that has been carried out in the States has pointed to a decline in civic engagement. And so it's early days really with this research and the attempts to link this. But I guess the implications are that people become less concerned with what's happening in their communities because they don't have as much knowledge of what's actually going on. And so we already have a phenomenon called news avoidance, where a lot of people, you know, actively try to steer clear of the news. The extent to which that's linked to the decline in the amount of news being produced is open to question. But I think more and more the evidence points to there being a civic need for people to be able to be informed about what's happening in the environments in which they live.
Are there any areas in the world where this has been reversed?
Well, in the UK, there have been quite a broad range of experiments which have attempted to address the decline in the numbers of journalists by collaborations between a range of organisations that previously didn't work together. I know the BBC's been involved with local newspapers in the UK. But overall, this problem hasn't really been solved because the underlying issue that has led to this problem, which is the decline of advertising revenue for a whole range of reasons, but most recently including, you know, the extent to which Google and Facebook have gobbled up the advertising market, have meant that there are structural problems which, for commercial media, which have been very difficult to reverse en masse. And so everybody's trying to address this issue, but without, it seems, some kind of public mechanisms or subsidies or incentives that can be operationalized to ensure that some of the money that's going to advertisers is flowing back into the development of content, it's very difficult to deal with this problem.
We heard earlier Michael McCormack, the Nationals leader. Now, the New South Wales Nationals have just in the last little while said that they're going to suspend all of their TV advertising with Win as a result of this decision. Can you see people voting with their feet on this one?
It's difficult to know how well that might work. This is an issue perhaps in the case that's come up today with a particular company, but without knowing the specifics of Win's circumstances, the broader point I'd make is this is a structural problem. And so really solutions need to be formulated at a policy level, I think, that if they don't involve direct government subsidy, certainly involve creating an environment where it is possible for commercial media to be sustainable in regional Australia. And so I think that it's an issue for the government as well as for the broadcasters and those who produce the news.
Professor Zion of La Trobe University, thanks for making the time to chat to Australia Wide.
A great pleasure.
Looking to brighten up your winter garden? The July issue of Gardening Australia magazine profiles beautiful plants to add colour and interest, from vibrant primulas to compact grevilleas. There's tips for choosing the right tree for your garden, plus a terrific pruning special with easy step-by-steps and advice on tackling more than 30 shrubs. Learn how to make a mosaic bird bath and pick up all your jobs to do in the garden this month. Gardening Australia magazine, available from newsagents and gardeningaustralia.com.au.
A vaccine safety project developed in the New South Wales Hunter Valley has contributed to what is now a world-leading national vaccine surveillance system. VaxTracker was developed by researchers at Hunter New England Health in 2010, and then the program grew and combined with similar programs in WA to become the National AusVax Safety Program. Dr. Helen Quinn is a senior research fellow at the National Centre for Immunisation Research and Surveillance and leads the AusVax Safety Team. Now, Dr. Quinn, what happened in 2010 that prompted this?
So in 2010, there was an unexpected increase in the rates of adverse events, and in particular, febrile seizures. And that was specifically among children, young children, particularly under 5 years of age, who were receiving flu vaccine. And an investigation into that identified that there was one particular brand associated with that increase in fevers. And so a big investigation was conducted, and there was also a review done of vaccine safety surveillance and monitoring in Australia, and one of the recommendations of that review was that an active vaccine safety surveillance system would be established, and that sort of brought about the creation of AusVax Safety.
Dr. Quinn, do you think there has been a hangover effect of what happened in 2010 when it comes to people getting their children vaccinated for flu?
Yes, definitely. We've continued. There's a lot of researchers around Australia that do a lot of social science research into, worries that people have about vaccination. And, you know, we're very interested in making sure we maintain high immunisation rates in Australia, which we've been very fortunate to have. One of the things that we hope to do with AusVax Safety is provide reassurance to vaccine recipients and their parents. And one of the things that I guess is great about AusVax Safety is the data is coming direct from consumers. So they're reporting the reactions. So it's very comparable to the general public. It's direct from them. It also comes in quite quickly, and we can monitor that in quite a rapid way. And we get very large numbers. So for flu every year, we get hundreds of thousands of reports from people about their experiences with the flu vaccine, for example, across the age spectrum.
Before we had this chat, I did jump on the website and I could see the data that had come in as in from last week. In the context of the numbers, actually, the numbers of people with adverse reactions were very small in all age groups that I saw between April and June. So it was interesting. So there's real-time data. If you're a consumer like myself, you can hop on the website and have a look at how it's going if you've any kind of concerns about vaccinations at all. Now, Dr. Quinn, this flu season is being a particularly bad one. It means there's a strong interest in vaccination programs. What sort of information do people ask you about when it comes to vaccinations?
Biggest thing is really about safety. There's also an interest in when they should have vaccines and whether they should have vaccines at the same time as other vaccines. So one of the things our system does is allow us to look at getting the safety of vaccines given at the same time. And that's been particular of interest to us because, as many people would be aware, the National Immunisation Program, certainly with childhood vaccines, they actually get quite a number of vaccines at the one visit. If you're a parent and you're taking a child in, say, for a four-month-old vaccine, what the likely reaction rate would be following those vaccines and the types of symptoms that your child may get.
And what is the case? So if you are bringing your baby at 4 months for their regular vaccines and then they also need to get a flu vaccine, safety-wise, is that okay?
Absolutely. So, yes, flu vaccine can be given at the same time as another visit. It's really up to the parent and the doctor, you know, what they feel comfortable with giving. Obviously, it's another injection, and depending on how many they're already getting as part of the standard schedule, they may want to wait and have it a week later, or they may find there's a sort of two minds. Some people don't like the idea of giving another one on the same day, but then other people like prefer to get them all done in one day and get them over and done with. So it's really up to the individual. But sometimes if you're busy, you don't want to have to make another appointment. So certainly no harm in getting it on the same day.
And what about the timing of the flu vaccine? People, particularly in regional Australia, have struggled to get appointments to get their flu vaccine. Some can get to a pharmacist that allow that, but not all. Is it too late to get a flu vaccine now?
No, it's not. And quite positively, there has been a big demand for flu vaccine this year, which is we're very happy about, obviously. So no, not too late. I mean, it can be difficult when you do have to shop around a bit to find one available. I would say just keep trying. Companies and so in terms of the funded program, the government has assurance of supply and are continuing to get large amounts of stock in. And certainly for the private market, the companies are aware of the demand and are, you know, having every effort to bring more product into the country. So, there's definitely it is still out there and available. But, yes, unfortunately people are having to hunt around a bit. And it's just because, I mean, we've had a very early season this year, which was very unusual. And I think that's really brought on demand. And just, yeah, there seems to be more a growing number of people that are sort of becoming aware of the recommendations around flu vaccine, and it's being taken up.
Dr. Helen Quinn, the Senior Research Fellow at the National Centre for Immunisation Research and Surveillance, thanks for making the time for Australia Wide.
Thank you.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And if you are interested in finding out more about AusVax, you can go to their website. It's ausvaxsafety.org.au, and there's some really interesting statistics there to have a look at. A lot has been said about the migration of people from the bush to the city, but in parts of regional Australia, communities have gone to great lengths to welcome migrants and their families to rural life. These towns have found refugees bring new life to a town, address workforce shortages, and keep local schools open. One such spot is Wagga Wagga in New South Wales. An Amnesty International spokesperson, Shanka Kasinathan, tells Oscar Wilds that Wagga Wagga is standout in how it's made this transition work for newcomers and for the community.
Amnesty International chose Wagga Wagga out of all the many towns and cities that we're working in here in Australia because we wanted to send a message with that. And that is the importance of acknowledging the role that regional towns like Wagga Wagga play in helping to resettle our new neighbours, many of whom are refugees. Wagga Wagga absolutely leads the country in the work that happens here in the Riverina around resettling people safely and in a really integrated and supported way.
We are hearing about the good work that the Riverina is doing, but what more work needs to be done?
One of the wonderful things I think that Wagga Wagga could possibly do, and I think has started doing, is actually being inspirational in terms of being a regional leader to other neighbouring neighbourhoods and communities around it, encouraging them to look at what they could be doing as well. As, you know, Oscar here, there are a number of sort of towns that are now looking at that question around, hey, how can we step up and put things in place to create a more welcoming neighbourhood?
We have heard from smaller communities such as Walla Walla, another one being Tamora, saying that we would really like to attract some more people to town, skilled workers, to people to bring an extra element to these areas. It's easy to say that this is something that these places would like to do, but realistically, how easy or how hard is it?
Look, that's a really great question, and I think that, you know, there's an indication now across many regional towns. You know, there's a city in far north Queensland called Quilpie that, without blinking an eyelid, supported the My New Neighbour campaign and called for expanded improved community sponsorship, because there are communities that are saying, we are desperate for people. We're desperate to grow our city. We're desperate to grow the diversity of the skills and experiences that make the cultural richness of our city. How do we make that happen? I think that one of the important things is, you know, there's been a strong emphasis on service provision and making sure there's enough housing and healthcare and all these other things which make cities, you know, function and run. But the important thing, I think, and certainly I'm reflecting on this now, Oscar, as someone who came to Australia as a refugee myself and the experience of my family, is that you can have all those settlement services and they do the best that they can with limited resources. But one of the critical things I think that is important to resettlement is what individual sort of contributions look like, what sort of what clubs can do, what social groups can do in terms of providing sort of social inclusive spaces for people to sort of really feel part of the community. I think that I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's an economic sense and in a sort of service sense of the infrastructure around what does this look like and what can this mean for the city. But then filling big gaps are people saying, what can I do to help someone resettle in terms of literally holding their hand through this process?
That's Shankar Kasinathan of Amnesty International, and he was speaking to Oscar Wilds in Wagga Wagga. You're listening to Australia Wide, and you're with me, Sinead Mangan. A herd of cows has been showing some unusual behaviour in the town of Laverton in Western Australia. For the last few months, up to 20 of the animals have been roaming the streets of the Goldfields community at night in search of food and water. The bizarre behaviour has fuelled annoyance in some locals whose gardens have been trampled and backyards invaded, while others see it as a harmless spectacle. But for Wally Van Dam, cow herder extraordinaire, I don't know whether that's what he calls himself, it's all part of a day's work. Tom Joyner reports.
We might get him to move, mate. I don't like the two bulls, though.
It's a freezing winter's morning in Laverton, but Wally Van Dam doesn't seem to notice. He's wearing his trademark wide-brimmed hat, and a can of Coke rests precariously on the dashboard of the ute he's driving. His mission this morning is the same it's been every morning for the last few months, to round up cattle. Only they're a little further from home than usual.
Yeah, we generally leave home about anywhere between 4 and 4.30, come into town, do a very slow pass around, make sure there's no cows around, or usually there's a few on the oval. Anyway, so we muster them up, or you know, generally walk them off. We do that every morning, same time.
I'll go and check the hospital.
Roger.
And you can't rush them, you know, they love that nice, soft, mushy grass.
Since February, about 20 cows have been making their way under cover of darkness every night into the residential streets, alleyways and public spaces of Laverton in search of food and water. Along the way, they've been clumsily trampling over bushes and upending flower beds, and of course leaving their enormous telltale droppings strewn across the ground.
It's probably got worse, and I think from about the end of February it started.
Wally and his stepson Nathan spend the hours before dawn gently guiding errant cattle away from grassy verges and from under trees and send them on their way back home. Some locals have naturally been left a little bit annoyed by it, but they have seen the phenomenon before, just never on this scale. This year, something is different.
Yeah, it's more so this year because we haven't had our winter rains, so there's no water out there. But like I say, if we had winter rains, we wouldn't be having this problem.
Wally and Nathan work at a nearby cattle station, but the cows they herd every morning from town aren't necessarily theirs. The cattle wander in from any of the handful of properties that surround Laverton. In fact, the pair aren't even getting paid to do the job. There's no money to be made doing this.
I don't know. The reason why I do it is because I want to. I mean, I love the town.
Along the way, they stop for a cup of tea with locals and chat to early risers on their way to work.
The interaction between everybody in town is really, really good. And it makes you feel like we're doing something that people appreciate.
For those in town irritated by the cow raids every night, Wally can understand why. Maybe their flowers have been torn up or they've been woken up to piles of droppings throughout their lawn. But for many others, it's not such a big deal. After all, says Tony Lemazurier, the cows are just doing what cows do.
Apparently people say there is a problem with the cattle out here. Me personally, I don't have an issue with it.
Tony Lemazurier and his wife manage the local caravan park, and every now and then he likes to beckon to a passing cow with his own kind of convincing impression.
Can you demonstrate to me the sound you make when you get the cows come over again?
Oh, this is going to be different.
And while no one seems to know how long all of this will continue, Wally Van Dam is sure things are bound to improve soon.
We have got a fencing program which is going to be implemented this year. So that should stop some of them. But I don't think you'll ever stop all of them.
In the meantime, he and Nathan will keep up their morning ritual and the people of Laverton can rest easy knowing the pair will be there to make sure the cows come home.
Tom Joyner with that story from Laverton. And that's all from the Australia-wide team this evening. Don't forget, you can find this program on the ABC website, or you can listen back, or you can find the podcast. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.